Plato. Welcome to this special podcast of Science Friday from sciencefriday.com. This hour, we'll be talking about restoration, renewing, recovering things from the past that are in the process of fading away. Now, if I said art restoration, you'd know what I meant, right? Trying to bring an old painting back to life, or a sculpture, or perhaps, you know, seeing those vibrant colors on a 400-year-old masterpiece. If I said dinosaur restoration, you'd understand that too, right? Digging up fossils to build a model or a skeleton of a majestic animal that walked the earth tens of millions of years ago. But what if I said language restoration? We don't normally think about languages being restored, but as cultures fade away, their languages fade with them. Can they be preserved? What about less tangible things like hope, dignity, or meaning? If they're lost, can they be restored? And while restoration is an attempt to bring back what is lost, can we really recover what is gone? Well, that's what we'll be talking about this hour, the intersection of science and art in the process of restoration. Our guests, a sculptor, a novelist, a paleontologist, they are keynote speakers at the Utah Symposium in Science and Literature, focusing on restoration in images, words, and bones. And if you'd like to join our discussion, our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. And if you're in the audience at the University of Utah, where we have a mic set up there, please step up to the mic with your question. Let me introduce my guests who join me today from the Gould Auditorium at the University of Utah. Rachel Berwick is a sculptor who works in large-scale installation and is represented by the Brent Sikkema Gallery in New York City. She's also an associate professor at the Rhode Island School of Design in Providence. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Leslie Forbes is the author of Waking Raphael and of Fish, Blood, and Bone. She's also a presenter and writer of BBC Radio documentaries in London. Welcome to the program.
It's good to be here.
Thank you. Dr. Michael Novacek is the author of Time Traveler, In Search of Dinosaurs and Ancient Mammals from Montana to Mongolia. He's the curator of paleontology and provost of science at the American Museum of Natural History in New York. Welcome back to the program, Dr. Novacek.
Hi. Hi, Ira.
Hi, how are you?
Rachel,
let me begin with you. Your work, My Poray, is based on a very interesting story. An 18th century naturalist traveling to South America comes across an Indian tribe that spoke one language with parrots that spoke another. You take it from there. Tell us about it.
Sure. It starts actually with Alexander von Humboldt, who traveled down to, he was following the Orinoco River to its source. And the story goes that he was visiting with a Carib tribe, and they had some parrots, and he was, you know, doing what naturalists did, which was to collect specimens of plants and animals as much as he could, but he was also documenting the languages of the indigenous people he encountered. So when he was with these people, he noted, was observing their language, but he saw that their parrots were speaking a human language, but not the language of the tribe he was visiting with. When he asked about it, he found out that this tribe, this Carib tribe, had warred with a tribe called the Maipore, wiped them out, taken the parrots as spoils of war, and these were the parrots. So these parrots were the sole remaining speakers of this language, and therefore the sole trace to this entire people.
Wow, that's interesting. And so did von Humboldt actually document the language that the parrots were speaking?
He did. When I came across the story, he never lays claim to the story, but it has been published in a number of different publications. And I was so interested in the fact that a parrot could be the sole conduit through which you could trace a language and its people that I knew I had to do something with it. So I went and found his narratives of his travels and found where he did document my Poray phonetically.
And so you built a whole art installation around this.
Yes, I did.
Tell us about that.
Okay. Well, from there, I went to a linguist who helped me then put together some phrases that I could train some parrots to speak. I found a woman who works with birds. Her name's Sue Farlow, and she's a bird behavior consultant. She basically helps people with their problem parrots. And she was willing to help me learn enough about parrots in order to train these two parrots to speak a language. And then I acquired these two parrots, and my whole studio turned into basically, you know, a playpen for parrots. And while I was training these parrots to speak this language, I was also building a sculptural aviary in which they could live. So I can tell you about it now.
Sure. You tell us what we would see when we walked, if we went through your installation.
Yeah. Basically, what I wanted was for the viewer to walk into the space and see the aviary, which is a 10-foot diameter cylinder, and it's about 10 feet high. And it's covered with white translucent walls, plexi walls. So all you can see, because it's lit from inside, are the shadows of plants and the birds themselves and branches. And so I wanted the viewer to come in and just see all of these shadows and not necessarily discern one from another, only to, as they spend time walking around it, eventually discover that they might be looking at not the shadow of a leaf, but the shadow of a parrot. So there's this opportunity for discovery on this visual level. And on an audible level, I wanted that to happen as well. So you hear lots of noises, because I had a whole soundtrack playing constantly within the aviary, actually to keep the parrots interested and to sort of give them a kind of comfort zone away from the people walking in the exhibition. So I have the sounds of the jungle basically playing in the aviary. So you just hear all these noises, and you hear my birds speaking and the sounds of the waterfall or water fountain inside of there. And then every once in a while you hear what might possibly be a human word.
Hmm. Very powerful, it sounds.
Hope so.
novelist Leslie Forbes, you tell the story of Rachel Berwick and her My Poor Ace Speaking Birds in a radio play called Humboldt's Last Word, and you address this idea of restoring lost voices, but in a work of fiction. Tell us about the play.
Well, the play was, I warned Rachel that it would be about her, and yet it would, there would be a Rachel in it, but not her. So what I essentially did was to install the installer into my own installation. The play starts off, it was inspired by her parrots, but it was also inspired by the whole idea that many people who come into our country who are asylum seekers are forced to become parrots. We reward them when they speak English badly, and we punish them for speaking their own language beautifully because we're very suspicious of it and because we haven't learned their language. Now, as far as I'm concerned, people who speak another language are chemists, physicists, Einstein, and you might learn to speak a bit of his. You could say parrot fashion or pidgin English version of Einstein. And so the play begins with someone who inherits a parrot that she doesn't want and a parrot who has very bad language. And I was inspired not only by Rachel, but also by my neighbor, Arthur, who's an old Cockney in London who lived through the war. And his family had a parrot who had very foul language, and mother hated this parrot. The mother, every time a bomb fell on London, she said, "I hope it got the bloody parrot." And he would say, "Well, you know, we really love this parrot." But my mother would say, "Oh, he speaks every language except good English, you know." And one day, their host suffered a direct hit from a V-1 flying bomb, another flying winged creature like the parrot, and everybody cheered, thinking the parrot would be killed. But sadly, the only thing that survived this blast was the parrot. So the whole idea that on the one hand you want to restore things, but do you actually want to restore them? How far do you want to restore this? That's inherent within the play.
That's an interesting proposition. And Michael Novacek, I might use that as a segue to you, because as a paleontologist, you don't have talking parrots to help you, but you have bones that may be of birds these days, as we talk about dinosaurs and birds.
That's right. Yeah.
You faced different kinds of challenges trying to reconstruct the age of dinosaurs. Tell us about some of your biggest problems.
Well, I think that the first big problem with reconstructing lost worlds of the past is that most of it's gone. So, you know, 99% of all life on Earth is probably extinct. Imagine what that would be in human experience if your every waking day was one wherein 99% of your memory was lost. So in a sense, the life on Earth today, the memory of that life is erased from us, except for the small smattering of fossils that we have over a period of 3.5 billion years. So when you do have these incredible opportunities, these incredible situations where the record is enriched, that's obviously a source of great enthusiasm in terms of paleontologists and their work. Reconstructing a lost world, though, is a fragmentary process, because you can never get all of that world recreated. No matter how good that fossil record is, there's just enough of life today, the kind of life as we know it, that's missing from that. So you're always approaching this sort of level of perfection and reconstruction, but rather asymptotically, you never quite reach that.
Mm-hmm. But you go to sites and you try to do the best you can. Can you give us an idea what it's like when you go, let's say, to the Gobi? Walk us through some steps of trying to reconstruct a dinosaur.
Well, I think one of the marvelous things is the other side of the coin here, that even though the record is frustratingly incomplete, some fossils are extraordinarily informative in surprising ways we would have never predicted. So in our Gobi expeditions in the mid-90s, as you know, Ira, we were lucky enough to find this incredibly rich site in the southern Gobi Desert. And this not only had scores and scores of dinosaur skeletons in the sort of classic victorious way we think of paleontological discovery, but it had dinosaurs and other animals, mammals and lizards, that had a sort of a sense of preservation of behavior. We had these oviraptors nesting on eggs, you know. Here's a behavior, a sort of a nurturing behavior, very much like birds. In fact, the position of these oviraptors are very reminiscent of what we see in ostriches today. These animals were essentially buried in the act. Just like Pompeii may reveal many things, not only about the death of people, but their lives. And so there is, with all the frustration and the incompleteness of the fossil record, there are those bright moments. And so they allow us to go from digging these bones up in the ground to preparing them in the museum, and then to reconstructing them, you know, in the flesh or in these behaviors. One final aspect that's interesting about this is that when you're in the field and you find a fossil, you very often have no idea how important it is. First of all, you don't want to destroy it, so you wrap it carefully like a little baby in swaddling. You swaddle it with plaster jackets and you pull it out. And it's not until you get into the museum and start preparing it that you really begin to see things. You may not even know what it is, what kind of animal it is, until many months later.
Right. Michael, you said something interesting also about preservation and the fact that when you find these dinosaurs, they are in the nest, or you're preserving the act also that they were, you know, they were in as they died. And in the old days in museums, you might have just mounted the dinosaur bones and not cared very much about that. But that is now very much of the act of preservation, is getting the mounting and the positioning correct.
That's correct. And some of the most interesting work about dinosaurs in recent years is not on the skeletons themselves, but on the trackways. The trackways tell us that dinosaurs walked around in herds, that dinosaurs had a herd formation. Some of these big sauropods had a herd formation, much like modern elephants or elephants today, with the young on the inside of the herd and the big guys on the outside. Remarkably, some of the new evidence on trackways even suggest that dinosaurs in North America had a preferential direction of migration. They migrated somewhat from the north to the south. So, you know, we can really infer a lot about evidence from the fossil record, and this should all be part of exhibitry, because it's the way of bringing those scientific discoveries to light.
1-800-989-8255. Let's go to take a call from the audience there, who is ever at the microphone. Please stand up and share with us your question. All right, go ahead. Nope. No one's at the microphone. let me go to the telephone then. Let's go to the phones to Deborah in Akron, Ohio. Hi, Deborah.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Go ahead.
Yes, my question is really more with the things, I think, within some realm of workability that we have some control over, that is the language and the arts, particularly of people. And my question or comment is that this question of restoration to me has really no, it doesn't matter if we don't change the social constructs, society, institutions, et cetera, that made these things die out in the first place, be it language, people, arts, you know, all of that. I'm not a scientist, so I'm not real sure about the paleontological part of things, but I am concerned with the demise of languages and peoples and cultures and parts of the world that are not as.
So you don't think we should leave it as a sort of a natural evolutionary construct, the way these things happen? You think we should be actively preserving them?
Well, some things I think we can preserve. The environment, I think some of that we have to chuck up as a loss, because some level of it the institutions are not going to change to make it such that things are biologically compatible and living with harmony with the universe and the world. So, you know, those things we do have control over is where I think we should put effort such that when we do restore, we understand why it demised in the first place and we make sure it doesn't happen again.
Rachel Berwick or Leslie Forbes, do we know why this society died out and left the parrots behind?
Well, no, I guess we don't. I mean, from my perspective, it was from the war with the Caribs. And that's, for me, I mean, this isn't really related to the question, but for what I was interested in, it was really most important to treat the story as true and look at the possibilities that arise from that in terms of thinking about looking to nature as a means of recovering something which is ultimately culture. So the parrots being the conduit to this language and its people, and the fact that that really is possible. You know, parrots do speak. Parrots do actually understand what they speak. They can understand words in context.
How many words were they actually able to remember?
Oh, they're good. They've got about 25, 30 words in their vocabulary. But sometimes more, because they kind of hide words sometimes, and they come out, won't say them for months, and then they do.
And being a lost culture, do we know what these words mean?
Yeah, we do.
Yeah.
I mean, von Humboldt, when he recorded them, he did record the meaning. So,
I
mean, you know, and you also have to accept that there's certainly a certain number of removals, because von Humboldt, you know, recorded them phonetically, and he published his narratives in French, but then, of course, I read the English translation. But if you put five different people in a room and ask them to write the same word phonetically, they're going to do it five different ways. So there are lots of levels of removal. And, of course, the birds then put in their own improvements in the words.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's go to the audience. There is someone at the mic would like to ask a question. Yes, go ahead. Well, are you at the mic? The mic is on because we're having trouble hearing you. We can't hear you back here.
Yeah. Yeah. Can you hear me now?
No. He's doing a cell phone commercial. All right. We'll go back to you. We'll figure out what the problem is, and we'll see if we can please have a seat. I can hear you in an echo, but I can't hear you actually on mic. So see if you can go back. Michael Novacek, while I have you here, let me take this opportunity to ask you about this finding of a T-Rex bone which has soft tissue in it, this unprecedented finding. What's your take on this?
Well, just another example of new discoveries in the fossil record that tell us a lot more than what we could anticipate. This study's just come out, and there will probably be a lot of scientific scrutiny and discussion. As you know, that always happens, invariably happens with these things. But I think it's pretty clear in the article and the figures in that article that it's preserving a structure at the tissue level of organization, very much like one sees in ostriches and modern birds. This is vascular tissue. It's right now, in a sense, a remarkable finding, but it doesn't tell us much about, say, the next level of possibilities. I think people immediately leap to the notion that, well, what, maybe we'll get DNA out of this that's really well preserved and it'll give us the correct signal for the genetics of Tyrannosaurus rex. And then the next step being, well, maybe we'll even clone a dinosaur. And I think those two latter possibilities are far remote from the last one being virtually impossible now as we can conceive of it. But those are very remote from the notion, nevertheless fascinating discovery of this tissue in the T-Rex bone.
Mm-hmm. Leslie Forbes, as a writer, how do you convey the idea of restoration that Michael Novacek is talking about when he restores his bones and dinosaurs?
Well, you mean the uncovering of bones? Well, I'm very keen on bones myself. I do a lot of digging down and a lot of dusting off. And I'm very interested in
That's what the bone work you're talking about.
I'm very interested in elementary particles and how we get back to them. But I'm also interested in why myths persist and why certain things, we are so interested, for example, in dinosaurs, which have a kind of funky interest about them, and less in language. We're happy to allow a language to die because it's not relevant to us now. And I don't mean just a language in which you say, hello, how are you? I mean a language in which you say, hello, how are you, in terms of a particular chemistry or particular health idea, say, for example, in Nepal or in southern India, where they have lots, and in South America, where they have lots of natural herbal things that they can help us. And if we allow that to die out, that is a language. If we allow the people who know about those things to die out, then we cannot possibly survive in the future if we haven't taken into account what they know. And as a writer, I cover those situations a lot, because I think very often scientists are forced into giving a nice, neat soundbite, because what we want them to do is to say something easy, and it's not easy. Restoration is not easy. For example, if you want to take subjects like, if you think of genetic modification, we can genetically modify plants. But that's not something that you can say easily. You can't say it in two sentences, like summarizing a novel. Whereas in a novel, you can take the issue of genetic modification and you can discuss it. You can have a protagonist and an antagonist take opposite points of view, and you can discuss this in a way that we don't even get a chance to in newspapers, say. Mm-hmm. And for me as a novelist, one of the reasons I started writing fiction is because I could no longer tell the truth as a journalist, because there were certain things I was not allowed to tell, whereas in fiction I can say what I like without being sued. So that is, in a way, is restoring the truth in a
certain
in a different
things
sort
you
of
can
way.
Say.
Certain things. I promise not to say them, though.
Well, that's interesting, because in Fish, Blood, and Bone, your character Claire is a forensic photographer. She uses photographs to piece together the circumstances surrounding someone's death. This seems to be very much in vogue, at least on American television now. The TV is full of forensic photographers and forensics of all kinds.
I don't watch American television, so I don't know. But it's based entirely on a case that happened to me, in which I was the witness to a murder in my street and had to help a forensic. Well, in fact, in Britain, the things I do watch are American police dramas. So, you have these computer simulations that show you what a criminal looks like. In Britain, we still had people who drew, but very badly. And I thought this was quite interesting, because it's a very weird way of reconstructing something. So on the one hand, you're dealing with forensic science, but on the other hand, you're dealing with very bad forensic art. So it was not a good mixture of art and science.
I could see a new Monty Python show, really bad forensic drawing, truly bad forensic drawing. That's 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's see if we can get that audience mic working again. Let me go to the audience. Hi, welcome.
Am I here now?
We can hear you now, yes.
All right, restored the microphone. My name is Jesse Powell. I'm an undergraduate student here at the University of Utah in German and biology. my question was, in the process of restoring and digging through the past, you must get a sense for what you wish was there, what you hope to find there. Does this give you a sense of what you would like to preserve for your own generation, or for later generations, what you would like to have kept that other people later on find?
Michael?
Yeah, it's an excellent question. I think that it's a funny thing, actually, being a field paleontologist looking for things. Despite all the sophisticated discussion we always have about this or that, we need this species because it would be very important link between dinosaurs and birds or the origins of mammals. When you're out there, you simply want to find things that are really great, really cool, very good fossils. And I think there's a little bit of that kind of spontaneity into it, and it's really sometimes only after the discovery that you really you start to think about what's important for people to carry on, that collective memory and those collective lines of evidence and what you put in collections and what you put on exhibit.
Mm-hmm. Does that answer your question? Oh, he's gone from there. Thank you. Do people say to you, "Oh, you should have come back with this instead of that," at all, or you get second guessing?
Oh, all the time. because the paleontologists can be content with very lousy fossils, because they're trained well enough to learn a lot from a little piece of bone or a trackway. So people say, "What? Is that all you got? You spent all summer?" I said, "Look at this. Isn't this tremendous?" Now, the Gobi, we don't have that problem because the fossils are spectacular. But many of the other expeditions I've been involved with, I've come back home feeling quite good about myself and the little crummy fragments of bones and teeth that I found, whereas colleagues in the public may say, this isn't exciting at all. It's only when you tell the stories, in the sense that Leslie and Rachel are explaining, that you tell the stories around those bones and around those fragments, that they say, aha, well, that, well, there is something there.
Yeah. And Rachel, you tell a story. You have a current installation which opened last night in Salt Lake City called A Vanishing. It depicts the extinction of the passenger pigeon. Describe what I would see if I were looking at your exhibition.
Oh, that's evil. It's a very difficult one to describe, but I'll try. The room is about 20 by 30, and it's a rectangular space, and what I did was to cast about 500 passenger pigeons from a taxidermied specimen, and then I cast them out of a material that's called copal, which is basically a young form of amber, so it's a fossilized tree resin and looks very much like amber. And the way I've arranged them is to suspend a number of brass rods from the ceiling of the space. And these brass rods extend from the ceiling to the floor, and they're evenly spaced, creating one next to the other, creating two rows that intersect the space, creating an X in the space, meeting in the center. And so the birds are arranged on the rods so that the outermost rods that are near the corners have birds that extend from floor to ceiling, one over the other. And then the next rod in has fewer birds, and then the next one in has fewer. And successively, as you get towards the center, each rod has fewer and fewer birds until you come to the center rod that just has one. And this whole piece was about Martha, who was the last surviving passenger pigeon in captivity for the last 5 years of her life. And it's also about the way in which the passenger pigeon went extinct, because they used to fly in flocks of hundreds of thousands of birds. And the idea, well, nobody could imagine that they would go extinct, and they did, just really from overhunting and irresponsible hunting. They went extinct very quickly. And the other thing that I did in relationship to that was to have very specific lighting in the space so that the birds and the rods cast shadows all around the space. And that's, of course, multiplying the birds, but in shadow. And also multiplying the bars or the rods, the brass rods, so that they, in essence, become bars of a cage, much like the cage that Martha was in when she died.
So you actually get to watch in the exhibit. I had a picture in my mind, the process of extinction by seeing the numbers of birds dwindling.
Yeah, and it sounds very sad, and it is, but at the same time, I hope that there's an accomplishment of a kind of wonder, because the amber itself is incredibly beautiful. So at the same time that it has all of these, you know, properties, physical properties that are related to recovery or slowing time or stopping time or preservation, there's this possibility of the hope of recovery in a way. And the material itself kind of captures and refracts light. So, you know, looking at it and walking around and seeing the way that it picks up light and drops light as you walk around the space hopefully sort of makes you think about something fluttering between life and death.
1-800.
So there's some hope there.
Oh, that's, hope is good. We like that. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Talking this hour about restoration, and we have people from different walks of life of restoration, a sculptor, a novelist, and a scientist talking about artwork. And I'd like to ask Rachel Berwick, who is a sculptor who works in large-scale installation. If you went to Michael Novacek's museum in New York, and I must assume you've been there, because just about everybody's been there on the East Coast.
It's my favorite museum in the world.
There you go. You go in and you see the arrangements of dinosaurs and things. Do you get any ideas as a sculptor how those things are arranged for creating any of possibly of your own exhibits?
Well, the reason I go there is to get my ideas. Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's meeting Michael's been just amazing for me, because I use the Natural History Museum a lot for reference, and particularly for research, because all of my projects are so kind of heavily laden with research at the beginning part of the making process. But yeah, I get ideas all the time. I send my students there all the time. I think the Natural History Museum is the most amazing place to learn about art.
Well, there you have it. We need a special pass for her to get there.
Yeah, I'm working on that. That's
Let's go to the audience there. A question at the mic. Yes, go ahead.
Yes, my name is Jessica Reed, and I have a background in physics and poetry, and my question is regarding language when we cross disciplines. It regards the level of verisimilitude when we adopt or parrot another language. So setting aside the practical limitations that you can't learn every language, you can't learn chemistry, physics, etc., but how responsible are we to get it right or as right as possible? Or will pigeon quantum physics and pigeon literary theory or rhetoric suffice?
Is that a question for me? I think it probably is.
It's probably directed towards.
I think you have to have an Italian attitude to this. Now, my version is I speak French and Italian. When I learned Italian, the Italians are delighted if you just say ciao. They think you're wonderful. The French, on the other hand, look really upset about it. If you say anything to them, even thank you, merci, they look really sneery. So my view is that both disciplines have to have a kind of patience with the other person. On the other hand, I've talked a lot of artists, and I'm categorizing writers under artists here for simplicity's sake, tend to love the metaphors of science. So it's very easy. You immediately hook onto Richard Dawkins' The Selfish Gene. And of course, he's been heavily criticized for that because it simplifies a very, very kind of vast, difficult subject. And it also gives a personality to a gene, which it doesn't necessarily have and probably doesn't have. On the other hand, my view is if you get anybody who doesn't think about science and who would never go into a bookshop and buy a popular science book, however popular it was, to read about science, even if you are somehow downgrading, dumbing down the science a bit in order to get them to read it, they may move on. In the same way that people don't necessarily eat olives when they're babies, but they move on to olives when they're 35, you know, that, I think that that's, you have the same attitude to science. And I think the more you can spread the word, I mean, what I'm worried about is that if the people who don't know about science say, well, I can't learn about science because it's all very complicated. The scientists then can only listen to the people who do know about science. They can only listen, and they can only be controlled by the controllers. Whereas as long as the people who don't know about science try to learn a bit about science through poetry, through literature, through thrillers, through crime writing, through painting, then they can continue to question, they can continue to put sort of efforts that the controllers keep controls on. We need global controls, not on the scientists and on the science, but on the people who control that science and those scientists. So by all means, I think, use those metaphors, even if, you know, people get cross and say, you're not speaking my language very well.
All right, thank you for that question. 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Southold, New York. Hi, Michael. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, how are you?
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call. I have a somewhat different form of restoration. I restore old wooden boats. And a lot of some issues come up that are sort of interesting. One being, if you restore a wooden boat that was built, let's say, 100 years ago, to what point do you restore it? Working boats have very often had many different kinds of lives: a fishing boat, a charter boat, a cargo vessel, and so on. And who's to say that the restoration should go to one of these things or another? Another issue is that. You know, sometimes in order to make the boat usable, you have to replace so much of it that people will start to say, well, is this really the same boat? And I sometimes tell them, well, it may not be, you know, maybe 90% of the boat has been replaced. But I like to say that its soul is still there. Or if it's inhabiting the same airspace or the same space in your yard, then it's still the same boat.
Yeah. How do you know? It's an interesting question. You know, if you, I like to talk about this when I go to Europe or old, you know, where there's, here in the States, we don't have that long a history, but you go back centuries, let's say to the Minoan culture, and you go to Greece and you see all kinds of restorations. And there's always this little black line along the wall that tells you where the actual structure stopped 2 feet above the ground, and everything above it is how we think it looked.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, sure. That's in this case, it's usually pretty easy to tell. You know, there are plans, there's enough literature, and so on. And the boats themselves will tell you a lot because although they're in pretty bad shape, they still, you know, you still know what the construction methods are. But
well, let me get a reaction from Leslie Forbes. Leslie, there's got to be a certain amount of geologic liberty, might be the right terminology for it, but.
Well, actually, Actually, it's very opposite to my book, because one of the things I raise in the book is that in Waking Raphael is when a painting has been restored and restored and restored to the point where there's nothing left of Raphael, is it still a Raphael? And does it matter? And that you could say the same thing about humans. There was a big case in the news in the springtime last year, and about this woman who was getting back to her inner woman by having her breasts enlarged from 34D, I think, to a 36EE, whatever that means. I don't know what it means. And then the biggest issue was that she was actually a man. So you could say, well, at what point had the restoration to her inner woman gone too far? I mean, because, you know, where was the inner woman? Obviously back in the womb. So it's a tricky situation to describe. You could also say, but then to on a more serious note, in terms of the people I work with, victims of torture in my country, using fiction to help them, to restore their voice. They're quite often muted by their lack of English. They're muted by the lack of interest displayed by the press in them. And how far do we want to restore them back to? At what point have we over-restored them? Are they still that same boat? If we teach them English and get rid of all their culture and wipe their memories, their sad memories, and give them Seroxat or Prozac and make them happy, are they the same boat? Are they still an original Iranian who was put in prison? Or are they now just a non-person? Have we made them invisible by over-restoration?
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the floor for another question. Yes.
Hi, I'm Adrienne Martin from the University of Utah. I'm an undergrad in English teaching and Spanish teaching. And I have read Michael Novacek's Time Traveler and also Leslie Forbes's Fish, Blood, and Bone. And I was just listening to a short talk by Mauricio Mixo, who is from the Department of Linguistics at the University of Utah. And he brought up a very interesting point when he was talking about code breaking and what that meant. He was discussing how you can decipher Mayan hieroglyphics or the Rosetta Stone and find, you're always trying to find a story, but he was talking about a specific case in which they deciphered this language that was from a tribe in California, and it turned out to be the Lord's Prayer, and he mentioned, what exactly does that tell us about the people? Nothing. And I thought that was especially relevant considering that Michael takes us into the world of paleontology through the story, and Leslie Forbes' novel centers around actually finding what that story is. And to Rachel Berwick's work, which you do not know what the language is telling us, what does that tell us when we do not know what the language is, and how do you tell a story with that?
Rachel?
Gee. I don't know if I'm answering your question here, but with my work, that idea that you have this inkling of recovery in that moment that you hear something that might possibly be a human word, you know, it's very fleeting, because as soon as you hear it, it's gone, and the birds aren't ever going to say it again the same way, or they will, but it's not going to be on command, and they'll distort the word as much as they'll say it correctly. So there's a lot of questioning in what I look at in terms of this, the desire to recover, really the questioning is, at what point do you actually recover something? It's a very emotional thing. I guess I actually look at the fact that it's really impossible to restore it completely, but something else takes place there, which is your own process of seeking. I don't know. I'm not sure if I'm answering your question.
But your birds exhibit tells the story of the pigeons, right?
A vanishing tells a story. Yeah, that very specifically does tell a story of an extinction and of a loss, yeah. And so really directing it towards that, I think all of the formal decisions that I make and the material decisions that I make do lend themselves to the story. And I think viewers can certainly approach the work without even knowing the story, because there's a kind of physical, visceral experience that you have, which when I'm talking about discovery or the viewer's relationship to the story, I think you don't have to have the story itself in order to experience the story.
Well, that's my next question. How much do we have to have a story in making it relevant to people? people, or it just, yeah. you know, it doesn't seem like just the restoration is good enough. I'd say, oh, look, that's a nice painting, that's a nice sculpture, or look, those are nice birds lying in a circle, or look like dinosaurs, you know.
Yeah, when I think about the subject, I think about the accumulation of memory and the accumulation of history. And, you know, one thing going back to that idea of restoring something back to what it was originally, what you do then is potentially just erase the history of it. And so at one point, you know, have you actually erased what it is, because you've erased its history and its memory. And a lot of my work does focus on this idea of trying to, looking at memory as something which you can't just conjure up. You know, it's really something that really can only come back truly through the actual experience, you know, having that Proustian thing of having the experience, living the experience again, and then that thus having remembrance.
Mm-hmm. Michael Novacek, how much of your restoration work is science? How much of it is artwork? Do you think of it as artwork a bit?
Well, I'm certainly thinking about it more since I've been to this symposium. But I have truly thought about this quite a bit, and it's a very interesting thing, and some of the questions, I think, connect with it. Let me give you an example where science, where there's a reciprocation, I think, between writing and science, art and science, is extremely important in terms of communication, not only to lay people, but also to scientists. We have a sense that the Earth is 4.5 billion years old. We can radiometrically date that with great precision. We can say, you know, in life form, 3.5 billion years old. But those numbers, in terms of our experience or our sensitivity, are basically meaningless. It's like an astrophysicist telling us there are billions of galaxies and billions of stars in the sort of Sagan-esque way, and not really having an impression of what that means, you know. And I think we have to leave some of that to writers. Writers tell us through their poetry. Yeats has a wonderful poem about where he's walking on an old rune, and it's about the best description of what it's like to walk in the field and find fossils that I know of. It's you know, we need to leave a lot of that, or we need to write it ourselves, or work with writers, or leave a lot of that to writers, because that gives us the connection to human experience and sensitivity that's really meaningful.
Or also, when you display the findings that you bring back from the Gobi or wherever you are, you have to give it some sort of perspective in the history of the universe.
That's right. And I think that those perspectives are not all in terms of raw numbers or probabilities and other very important scientific facts and factoids. Their senses of experience. What does this mean to you as a human being? Where does this put you in the universe? Where does this put you in relation to other organisms mm-hmm. on Earth and so forth?
Mm-hmm. Let's see if we can get a call from the phones here. Brooke in South Haven, Mississippi. Hi, Brooke.
Hi, how you doing?
Hi, go ahead.
I have a question actually about the parrots. I was just interested to know, like, how much of the culture are you able to recreate? Like, are you able to figure out possibly what context some of those words that you recover are used in? Or, like, how much do you actually get from the parrots?
Good question. Rachel or Leslie, can you answer that?
Well, I don't know that I get something from the parrots. I've given something to the parrots, and then they give something back. And I was talking before about removal. I mean, at the point that the parrots are giving something back, the levels and the degrees of removal from what was being spoken, you know, by the Maipore people is pretty extreme. I mean, I had words that von Humboldt, I trusted von Humboldt, recorded correctly. But as I said before, you know, his narratives were published in French. I mean, he was German. He published them in French. I got the English translation, and then I took it to a linguist, and this linguist helped me. I had to go through a number of linguists before I found somebody who would tolerate me, but then he spent some time with me putting together phrases that I could teach the birds to speak. Now, you know, I think that at a certain point, the creative process of restoration is really taking on a life of its own.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've run out of time. I'd like to thank all of you for taking time to talk with us. Rachel Berwick, sculptor who works in large-scale installation and associate professor at the Rhode Island School of Design in Providence. Leslie Forbes, author of Waking Raphael, published by Bantam Books, and also she's written Fish, Blood, and Bone. and she's a presenter and writer at the BBC Radio, radio documentaries in London. Michael Novacek, author of Time Traveler in Search of Dinosaurs and Ancient Mammals from Montana to Mongolia. He's also curator of paleontology and provost of science at the American Museum of Natural History in New York. Thank you all for taking time to join us today.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for listening. Remember to visit sciencefriday.com for more information on this topic and every topic we talk about on Science Friday. See you next time. I'm Ira Flatow.